The Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. Today we have on Peter Phillips. Peter is a Sonoma State University sociology professor. He's the former director of Project Censored. He's the current president of the Media Freedom Foundation. It's an initiative for First Amendment freedoms. What's more important than that? We see them eroding so fast. Also, investigative research. Peter at MFF works closely with Mickey Huff at Project Censored. And Peter told me a few days ago that he spent some time in Cuba, and he spent some time personally with Fidel Castro. Oh, I'm so envious of Peter. What a marvelous topic to discuss.
Welcome.
Welcome, Peter. It's great to have you back. Oh, I think that is terrific. Fidel went through a terrible illness some years ago. The U.S., the people I call major media scoundrels, Peter, they wrote his obituary a number of times, and I think indeed he had a tough time and a very long recovery, but he's 86 now, I believe.
85, 86, right in there.
Yeah, right in the mid-80s, and I mean, he's still alive and kicking, and he's a blogger. He's a blogger. My goodness, I wonder whether he reads any of my articles.
He reads a huge amount, that's for sure. And last Friday, a week ago, this most recent Friday, I and 120 other journalists, writers, who were there for the International Book Fair, spent 9 hours with Fidel at the Havana Convention Center. And half that time he was speaking. He was quite vital. He would have commentary on the different readings he was doing, as well as the presentations by the different people there. We were pleased to leave him a censored 2012 yearbook, and we had a marvelous conversations. He's tireless. I mean, his power looks good. His mind is clearly still with us in a very strong way, and the only evidence of the illnesses he had is that he walks with the assistance from two of his bodyguards, so they're careful to make sure he doesn't fall. But he was quite engaged with the audience for a very long time. 9 hours of communications. We took a coffee break 4 hours into it, another coffee break 3 hours later, and then he gave a 2-hour speech. So it was quite amazing.
That really is amazing, Peter. My God, and if I reach that age, I'm about 9 years his junior, 8 or 9 years his junior, and if I get to that age in good health. If I can go 9 long hours a day, I can't imagine giving a 2-hour address along with everything else. But well, maybe I could. Every time I finish a program with marvelous guests like you, Peter, I feel like we easily could do a second hour. And once in a blue moon, it really, really happens. But once in a while, a guest, the last moment, something comes up, and they simply can't come, and it's just too late to get anybody else. Well, I don't like being the guest. I like featuring important people like you, but in a pinch, I can fill in. I can easily go the hour, and if I had a 2-hour program, I think I could do the 2 hours, but I'm still 8 years or so Fidel's junior. I wonder if I could do it 8 or 9 years from now.
Well, there were certainly people in the audience who were like dozing off during that whole process. We'd been there. Actually, we'd been at it all day because we picked up in a bus at 10 a.m. and went to several hotels, and we had 3 busloads of people, had a lunch, and then we started at 1 and went till 10 o'clock at night. Fidel's very concerned about environmental damage in the world. and runaway capitalism, and the inevitable, you know, threats that he perceives from who he calls the Yankees in the U.S. To Cuba. And there's a long history, of course, of terrorist acts coming out of the U.S. and undermining and spending of money for opposition and a variety of issues that it's quite amazing. And what's significant is we were there for the International Book Fair, and that was held in the fort, the old Spanish fort across the harbor from downtown Havana. And this fort's about a mile long and a quarter mile deep, and it was just packed. Every nook and cranny had book displays in it, from books all over South America and the Caribbean, Spanish language books mostly. But what was amazing was tens of thousands of Cubans were there, mostly young people under 25, which is the majority of the population in Cuba, having a marvelous time. There was music, and they were laughing and playing and looking at the books. I mean, our book there sold for 50 cents. And I gave a presentation a week ago yesterday to a packed room of people. And the interest, the enthusiasm that young people have for the written word and for the culture and the music of Cuba is amazing. And what's significant, and we really had these conversations because I spent most of the day with young students from Havana University who were literature majors and spoke English. So we had long conversations, and they, you know, they're in a generation and the generation before them that have never seen advertising. There's no advertising on television or radio in Cuba. So they know what a McDonald's is. They have internet at the university that they can see things. But, you know, when I said, well, don't you want a Happy Meal? They just laughed. They thought it was the funniest thing in the world. And
Peter, they don't know how lucky they are to be commercial
exactly.
free.
I mean, we're so inundated with massive advertisements that inevitably, you know, we put our defenses up, but they're still there. They're in our face. And this whole generation of, you know, probably 15 million Cubans have never experienced that. And so I saw little children just so excited about getting a book to take home. And, I mean, that in itself was worth the trip.
Peter, I must tell you, years ago, I declared the space inside my front door in my late years. I'm alone. I don't have kids around that might want to watch commercials. But in my late years, I declared my private space commercial-free. I really watch television. Usually I watch Russia Today to get the news, or I watch Press TV online. But if I turned on a movie to get sleepy after I get into bed and they run commercials, I mute it out whenever commercials come on. I absolutely refuse to let that pollution into my household, and I consider it absolute pollution. It's the enemy.
It really is. It's pollution. It's the front face of capitalism. Consume, have more. You're a human being, you're self-actualizing when you have things, and nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, there's full employment in Cuba. No one's homeless. Everyone has enough to eat. Education is free. Healthcare is some of the best in the world. So you have a socialistic system that works, and the people are, you know, supportive of that. You know, this idea that the U.S. is going to waltz back into Cuba after the Castros pass away at some point in the future is ridiculous. These young people I was talking to, I just ask them, you know, when the senior leadership passes, you know, are you going to be willing to you know, let the former Cubans come back and claim their property or turn the Hotel Libre back into the Hilton? And they said, no way, that's not going to happen. And, you know, there's a whole island filled with people that believe in what they've done and are proud of it. They're the number one organic farming nation in the world. A third of their GDP is providing health care to other countries. They're training doctors from all over the world. There's 830 Pakistani young people in medical school there that are at the level of graduating. And Pakistan became interested in Cuban medical care after the big earthquake there 5 years ago. And Cuba sent in teams of doctors to help with that. And so they've sent young people to Cuba to become doctors. So that's part of the whole thing. And it's a demonstration that socialism not only can work, but people can be seriously engaged in it, self-actualizing and believing, and find, you know, purpose in that process outside of consuming capitalist goods.
Oh, it's so true, Peter. The type of capitalism that the West has, led by America, and Israel has the same system, but mainly, well, most countries, of course, have the system, but really led by the Western ones where the Industrial Revolution began. It's predatory. It destroys people, and right now, across Europe, especially at its epicenter in Greece. Next Tuesday, I'll have an interview on Greece. I've written a lot about it. And, I mean, literally, not only are the people being destroyed, but the nation is being destroyed. Why? To assure that bankers get paid. You've got an unelected banker running the country, the prime minister, along with a complicit, corrupted parliament. They pass multiple rounds of predatory sanctions, impoverishing virtually the entire population. I don't know how these people can live. Well, they're getting angry. I don't know what they're waiting for, Peter. I've said it on this program. These politicians will never lift a finger to do anything for them. They need to revolt. They need a rebellion. They need to get these guys out and get people in that'll serve all the people of the country, everybody. Not just the fat cat bankers, and the bankers are the ones that don't even reside in Greece. And you see the same thing going on across Western Europe. Of course, bankers do the same thing in America. I just wrote an article I called Banker-Occupied Europe and America. Well, that's exactly the situation. You've got money power in private hands to make more of it, and they do it by literally transferring wealth, otherwise known as a grand theft, from the majority of people to them, and a small segment of society at the top benefits, and everybody else suffers, and it's going on so egregiously now. Who on earth, ordinary working people, could ever support a system like this?
Well, it's global. It's transnational corporate class that is the central banks, the multinational corporations, the folks that hang out in Davos every year, the Trilateral Commission, that are coordinating this top down. And the U.S. Military and NATO have become the police force for this transnational global class in the world, protecting the free flow of capital. Now, capital has become, it accumulates. And if it doesn't accumulate fast enough, they create more. So the Federal Reserve will just create tens of trillions of dollars, give it to the central banks to, quote, loan out, buy treasury bonds. The government is the spending mechanism in this process, or one of the big spending mechanisms. And it is they pushing austerity in order to maintain their 7% return on this capital globally, which is the target. It's the target return. They have to impoverish, literally have austerity programs in governments everywhere, get workers to take lower wages. Inevitably, this can't go on and continue to grow at these kinds of rates. The capital would be overwhelmingly concentrated, and ultimately it'll become worthless. We're already seeing high inflation here in the U.S. with gasoline and energy and food costs. They don't count energy and food in the consumer price index. So they say, oh, it's only 3 or 4%. When in reality, it's 12% or better. And that's the dollar slowly collapsing in terms of its value, to what it'll buy worldwide. And that's accelerating. So we're in for some major economic transformations here, not only in this country, but worldwide. And Greece, of course, is one of those countries on the cutting edge.
Boy, it certainly is true. In fact, all fiat currency, Peter, really in trouble are the ones that are independent. Maybe they'll manage in some way, but they have their own problems. Venezuela, its bolivar is not linked to the dollar, but Venezuela has its problems because of actions that America takes against it. So they have an inflation.
Well, they're creating their own currency there within a combination of several nations. The Supra to
oh they want to do that
do their own trade.
That would be marvelous to have an independent currency, whether it's an individual one in a nation or the Supra in Latin America, independent of the Western predators. I think that's marvelous, Peter. And of course, China has the yuan that I don't believe is still convertible to dollars, so they basically have control of their own monetary policy. But Europe is a horrible the eurozone, 17 eurozone countries. Talk about a destructive system. The euro expert, a man named Bernard Connolly, before the euro ever came out, he wrote a book in, I think it came out in 1995, and he basically called the euro system a harebrained idea, sooner or later to fail. You've got 17 dissimilar countries. You're packaging countries like Germany, an economic juggernaut, with a basket case like Greece. Greece has never really done its job compared to rival European economies. And now, of course, Greece is dying. I've used the comment that only its obituary remains to be written, and the predation going on against the country is just literally draining it dry. It'll end up an empty hulk worth nothing with an entirely impoverished country. But how do you pack 17 separate economies under a common system? You've got these rules. Well, you know, the big boys break the rules, but they hammer the small countries when they do it, even because there's no choice. It just happens. So
they hammer the working people everywhere.
They hammer working people everywhere. Exactly.
And undermine public employment.
Exactly right. And we're talking about UK, the terrible things are going on against working people. France, I think there are more austerity cuts coming in France. Germany is the healthiest economy, but in the last quarter, I think their GDP declined. So they'll extract a pound of flesh from their people. And I wonder, how much do people have to take, Peter, before they simply won't take any more and realize that relying on politicians to serve all of the people is living in a dream world. It's never happened. It's happened better at some times than other times. But today, the way the systems run, you got the ECB bankers, private bankers running the system in Europe. You've got the Fed in America. You've got other countries with their privately controlled central banks. These are private bankers that make money by exploiting people. When will people understand enough and rebel against this system and throw it out? If imagine what Cuba has done, Peter, with sanctions on a terrible sanctions, an embargo that's gone on since the early 1960s. And Cuba has stood up against it all. Castro has had hundreds of assassination attempts made against him. He's a survivor, a miracle that he's done it. I've written about Cuba a few times, not recently. I wrote about it overall, and I wrote one article. Oh, it was over a year ago, where I compared the Cuban health system with America's. If you get sick and you don't have an awful lot of money, like, or you don't have insurance, you sure want to be in Cuba, not in America.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, for sure. The health care there is just marvelous.
And you could go there, an American or anybody could go there, and if you get
you'll be taken care of.
They will take care of you free. Free first-rate health care, as good as what Americans get. You know, if you're a Wall Street banker, I guess you can get anything you want. You can get the world's specialist in any field that you want. But if you're an ordinary people, even with health insurance, and even the insurance companies will rip off their policyholders, the people in Cuba get much better care than the average American with insurance. What a difference. Absolutely. I can't imagine the Cubans wanting to give that up.
I can't either.
And free education, too.
It's taken for granted, you know. Health care is a right, and if you're sick, you get taken care of.
They
specialize. They're especially good in eye care, but they also deal with cancers. That's where Hugo Chavez went to Cuba for his health care with his cancer.
He sure did. And if he needs it, he'll go back. My God, I mean, if I really came down with a terrible health problem, I think I would seriously consider finding a way to go to Cuba. Well, I could go to Cuba. There's always a way to go to Cuba. I can't take a direct flight from Chicago. Maybe I could. I don't know. But
right now, the only way to get there from the U.S. is to be on an educational tour. So it's an organized tour, and you can go with a leader and be there.
What about as a journalist? Kind of journalist to get...
That's the magic word. If you're a journalist, you can go. So I went through Panama, because there weren't any flights direct. And then of coming back, the government had given me a visa, the Cuban government. And so, but I put down my occupation, both college professor and journalist. Because I do work for I'm a volunteer at KPFA Radio and Pacifica. So coming back, I had taken a lot of sound in that. And when you come through immigration, they say, oh, you've been to Cuba? And I go, yes. And I said, I'm a journalist. They say, oh, fine, welcome back. It's pretty much that simple.
That simple, wow. I would.
But you know what? But they won't. U.S. won't let Cuban journalists come to the U.S.
Well, there's no surprise about that, and I wonder with what I'm doing. I stick my jaw out every single day, Peter. I'm putting out a volume of articles, and I spin nothing attacking the U.S. imperial beast and the terrible stuff that goes on. About 15 minutes before airtime, I was invited to go on Russia Today to discuss U.S. fascism. And I've written a couple of times on U.S. fascism. I mean, it's a very, very serious threat with all the police state laws, and the latest one was slipped in to the defense appropriation bill at the end of the year that Obama signed after he said he wouldn't, giving the military authority to arrest and detain any U.S. citizen anywhere in the world, charged or uncharged, throw him in a military dungeon, either try him in a military tribunal, or leave them there to rot for life uncharged. If that isn't a police state, I don't know what is.
Exactly.
And
seeing it increasingly dangerous to every person in this country.
It sure is, especially people like you and me, Peter. You stick your neck out with Project Censored, with the Media Freedom Foundation. Mickey does. Anybody who does my kind of writing sticks it out. I know they have to know about me. I mean, I was told a long time ago, rest assured, what you're doing is being monitored. So I'm sure they follow this radio program. They follow my interviews, follow my articles, and I spin nothing. I hold back nothing. I attack this beast, and I openly encourage other people to do it. And it's very simple. If we don't do it, they'll just keep hammering us until they destroy us.
They have to keep doing it. As Fidel said, it's our duty.
It's a duty
to challenge the corporate, the neoliberal capitalist agenda. And he's really worried about the extinction of humankind with the direction that we're going. Because as monetary systems collapse, and there's going to be massive civil unrest, massive repression, and the potential ultimate use of nuclear weapons. I mean, that's just horrendously dangerous. And building, not only speaking out in resistance, but building movements like Occupy that challenges the transnational corporate class, the 1%. But identifying and doing research to identify who these people are. So we've been researching this company called BlackRock, which is a major investment management firm based in New York. And it's relatively new. It's a combination of several firms. BlackRock controls $3.6 trillion worth of assets. Real estate, fixed income, cash management, and they're trying for a 7% return. And so it's these kind of mega investment companies that are tied in with Barclays Bank. They own Barclays Bank, and they've got the CEO of Merrill Lynch is on their board, and so these are the money managers of the world in very concentrated form, and we came across them because we were researching labor issues with the Freeport-McMoRan Company, which is the largest extractor of copper, gold, and has huge deposits with their mine in Indonesia. And their Gasberg mine over there, this past year, they employ 8,000 people at about $3 an hour. And these workers went on strike in September of 2011. And so replacement workers were bussed in. The Indonesian military was hired by Freeport and local police to repress the strikers. Workers were killed, and the strike went on until about 2 months ago. And then there was a settlement nowhere near what the strikers wanted. Panetta was over there and visiting with Indonesia as a prep before Obama got there with the Indonesian government. And he actually made a statement of how well the Indonesian government was handling this strike. So Freeport-McMoRan is the largest gold mining company in the world is there. But their primary investor is this BlackRock Corporation. So it goes right to the top of the highest level managed money managers in the world, running, you know, having major segments of these companies that are repressing workers all over the world.
Oh, it's shocking, and I'm sure they have ties to the big Wall Street firms, J.P. Morgan Chase, Rockefeller's Bank, Goldman Sachs. There's a company, I don't remember the name, Peter, but a name that sounds, I think, a little bit like BlackRock, that Pete Peterson is a principal of, or at least he was. Somebody else is the CEO of this company. And is Peterson, as far as you know, involved in BlackRock?
Not that I know of, but it would be interesting to find out.
He certainly is the kind of person that would be the type that would be involved. A former, if I remember his credentials, he was a former Commerce Department secretary, but he's a banker. He was involved in predatory investment firms, and he believes that, he says it smoothly, but we have to get rid of these destructive policies like Medicare and Social Security because we can't afford them. Well, we can't afford them. We not only can afford them, we can afford a lot more. The problem is bankers controlling the nation's money to spend on wars, to give themselves big bonuses, to consolidate to greater size, to basically plunder at will at the expense of ordinary people. But under a public banking system that I wish we had, Peter, and we did way, way in the past. We had prosperity when we had public banking, but that goes back to the colonial era and for a short period under Lincoln during the Civil War era. I mean, imagine if the government controlled its own money, could create money interest-free. They could create as much of it as they want. The only thing that creates inflation is if too much money chases too few goods. But if you created limitless amounts of money and it all went into productive economic growth, you could have prosperity, inflation-free. You could have all these wonderful social benefits with a lot more money left over to do more. Those are the secrets the predatory bankers don't want the public to know. But that's the way the system has worked in the past. It could work that way again. But, of course, it doesn't because you've got the wrong kind of people running the country.
Well, there's people like Ellen Brown that are, you know, been writing about that for a good time now.
Oh, she sure has.
About creating state banks and local community banks and making sure that our money circulates and that right to do that. I mean, predatory capital banks are primarily engaged in taking money and trying to building a return on it. Community banks and local communities can be engaged in doing and prioritizing human betterment for their populations, which is what Cuba does. So you can invest in health care, you can invest in housing, you can invest in full employment opportunities for people. And and manifest a very different world. Corporate capitalism, top-down monetary concentration, it doesn't trickle down. Sure, it sure creates some jobs, but everybody's so insecure that it makes an unsafe world, that your corporation could transfer to another country, or your corporation is going to get bought out by somebody else and you lose your job. There's that kind of insecurity that all of people, working people, are faced with. I mean, it's just, we all worry about that. Well, what would happen if my company closed? What would happen if I lost my job? There's no safety net, nothing of any variety. And even as a full-tenured professor at the largest state universities and system in the country, I still worry about that. Well, what if they decided to close some of the universities, or maybe they're, dismantle that? I mean, there's no backup.
There's no backup at all, Peter. They can do anything they want. I know one tenured university professor in Canada who was fired. This is a Denny Rancourt, a world-renowned physicist, an expert in his field, also an environmental scientist, an expert in environmental science. And because of his, he used creative teaching methods that his students performed better under than the previous ways that were taught that are conventionally used. They used that as a pretext to get rid of him, but that wasn't the reason at all. The reason was that he stood tall for Palestinian rights, and he expressed his views. And the president of the University of Ottawa, a former Canadian official, UN ambassador, a typical ex-government type, and Canada very one-sidedly supports Israel the way America does, and they went after Denny, and they not only got rid of him, they barred him from campus under threat of arrest. I mean, it was brutal. I mean, it was like fascism arrived at the University of Ottawa. And I wrote about him a couple of times, and there's a lot more going on with him, too, very repressive. This is the kind of stuff that goes on. And U.S. professors have been fired for their support for Israel. In Chicago, Dorman Finkelstein, Joel Covell in New York, Bard College.
Finkelstein was up for tenure, and they didn't give him tenure.
Joel?
Finkelstein, yeah.
Oh, Finkelstein, I think, was up for tenure. He was, but instead...
And they didn't give it to him.
It to him, that's right.
That's one of the little catches. If you get too mouthy or too challenging and too well-known to issues that your board of trustees are concerned about, the word could come down that we don't want to tenure this person. And because once tenured, it's far more difficult to... If you have a good union, it's far more difficult to get rid of you, but that has happened as well. It certainly happened to Ward Churchill at the University of Colorado.
Oh, it sure did, and he's the one who fought back the hardest. Peter, let's take a brief break, and we're a little past the bottom of the hour. You can catch your breath, maybe get a sip of water, and quick break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back on with Peter Phillips. Peter is professor of sociology at Sonoma State University and also the head of the Media Freedom Foundation, standing up for free expression. That's the right, Peter, I call the most important, without which you lose that one and all others are at risk, literally. If we don't have the right to speak freely, they can strip us of everything because we have no way to respond, no way to defend ourselves, and I think they're coming after us to take that right away, targeting the internet, targeting net neutrality. We didn't beat, but we derail, we slowed down the SOPA Piper train that targeted internet freedom, but the ACTA train is in full motion. There is a Pacific Partnership Alliance, an ACTA clone, that's the best way to describe it, and in some respects it's even more repressive than the ACTA one targeting free expression, internet freedom. And Obama is leading the charge for both of these. Well, Obama circumvented the Congress and signed on his own initiative ACTA. How do you do that? Technically, it's a treaty, but he claimed it's not a treaty, so he did not need the Senate to ratify it. He went ahead and signed it. Well, Congress knows what's going on. Oh, there were a few voices objecting. But where's the rest of Congress? Why are they letting him get away with this? Where's the public? The public was completely outraged about PIPA and SOPA. What on earth are they doing about ACTA? Well, they haven't done much of anything about it, and they know nothing about this Pacific Partnership. That's the same thing. And again, Obama, the man who promised as a candidate to save net neutrality, is leading the charge to destroy it.
Congress is literally the lapdogs of the transnational corporate class, and there's a few independent voices, Kucinich and a few others, but they know very well that they won't be there if, in fact, they get targeted by the billionaire companies that will, you know, now can spend all they want propagandizing against them. In an election or any other way. So money has really won in terms of the political process, the electoral process in the U.S. This idea that we can elect somebody who represents the people is a fallacy. And, I mean, that's beyond. And we know, you know, clearly the 2004 election was fraudulent. We're already seeing Brad Friedman's talking about some of the fraud that's going on in the elections that are going on right now. And we don't have a secure electoral process. We don't have multiple candidates that are anybody that would challenge the transnational corporate class in some real way. We had Rocky Anderson on our radio show yesterday or Friday on KPFA. Actually had him on twice, and he, of course, is an independent candidate for president and running in the Justice Party, and is pretty strong. I mean, he's certainly better than any of the candidates in the Democrat or Republican Party in terms of human rights issues and that kind of thing, but hardly anyone knows about him, and he certainly won't be included in any presidential debates, and he doesn't really have a national party that can get him on the ballot in states all over the country. So all the rules, everything is set up to oppose anything besides Democrat and Republicans, which are really, you know, one corporate party, from taking any kind of action or any kind of independent movement. So we don't have an electoral process. We're no longer, if we ever were, a democratic process in this country.
I don't think we've ever had a democratic process, but at some brief points in time, Peter, it more resembled it than it did other times. Oh, we had the New Deal years under Franklin Roosevelt. We had the Great Society, even Harry Truman a little bit, but there never really was much democracy. The power system runs the country. It just gets more extreme, more repressive over time. I think I wrote about this two or three times, but I'm going to go on Russia Today at 2 p.m. my time, noon your time, Peter, talking about fascism in America. It really is more apparent now, and they asked me on after Ron Paul, I believe, in a speech earlier today, accused America of becoming a fascist system. I'm not a Paul supporter, but imagine a U.S. politician giving a campaign, a presidential candidate, no less, giving a campaign speech and saying America
and
is becoming a fascist
yeah.
system.
Yeah. But in many ways we are. And if we define fascism as corporatism and corporate control of the power process inside the country and globally, with a military and police force designed and with legal opportunity to repress people, disappear people, murder people, and put them into prison without habeas corpus, we're in this combination of you know, repression that is potentially a strong fascist dictatorial process.
It really
and
is.
Certainly, the laws are in place as they were in Germany in the 30s. Well, everything Hitler did was, quote, legal, and according to the laws that were passed at that time, we've allowed presidents to have executive power concentrated in their office to arrest, kill citizens and non-citizens alike anywhere in the world.
That's exactly right, and it's not new. It's worse now than it's ever been before, enough to get a presidential candidate to actually call it a real threat. But back in the 1930s, my God, during the Roosevelt years, you had Sinclair Lewis write a book called It Can't Happen Here. It was fiction, but it was about a fascist dictator rising to power and running America.
And a populist movement, exactly.
And George Saldus, this wonderful man, he worried about fascism in the 1930s. He wrote a couple of books about it, including The Militarists. He talked about the munitions racket. So this stuff isn't new. It's been around a while, but it gets worse and worse over time. In the 1980s, Bertram Gross wrote a book called Friendly Fascism, and he used Ronald Reagan as its prototype leader, a friendly face. Fascism with a friendly face. You know, the stormtroopers won't march through the streets, but the repression will be there, and the leader will be smiling. All instead of a scowling Hitler, you get a smiling Reagan, you'll get a smiling Obama, you get these type of leaders, but the system's the same. And of course, post 9/11, they've just been a whole host of police state laws, and literally they can do anything they want to you anytime. They can disappear you, and nobody will know where you went or what happened to you. You could be completely innocent, but they can do what they want with impunity, and that's the threat anybody faces, but especially people who stick their chin out like you and me, Peter.
Well, you know, I think about that, and people ask me that often, you know, do you feel, you know, threatened? And we're meant to feel threatened. We're meant to feel afraid. And, you know, I have to say that there's tens of thousands of us that know this. And there's millions more that you know, support the kinds of conversations we're having and the kinds of actions and believe in it. But there's things that every person in this country can do. You know, we all have small groups of people, family, friends, associates, classrooms, you know, that we are with. And the questions that need to be asked, I mean, think of a, you know, young person sitting down to dinner with their family and saying, Mom, Dad, do we support habeas corpus? And, you know, yeah, we do. Well, gee, it's been suspended in the country. Oh, really? And, I mean, it becomes that kind of a conversation that needs to be happening in every locker room and every business and every family across this nation. Do we support torturing people? You know, those are the kinds of core value questions that we must ask and continue to stand on. You know, who would Jesus bomb? Which is one of Rovick's songs. And those are the moral questions that are being replaced and suppressed by a paternal government that wants to have us all be afraid. And the more the war on terrorism continues, the greater we will have, the greater insecurity that will exist. Because the more people we kill in the world, the more people are going to hate us. And with 1,000 military bases, and we're killing people in 100 countries all over the world, and our special forces are doing these kinds of repression and engaged in this kind of terrorism. It's state terrorism.
It's state terrorism.
You kill people,
Peter,
and civilians die. It's state terrorism.
It sure is. And people have more power than they realize. When enough people decide that they simply don't want to take this anymore, if they'll only take the trouble to find out what really is going on, they ignore the foreign wars. They know nothing about U.S. special forces in many dozens of countries around the world. Hit squads. These are death squads roaming the world. They could be anywhere. They could be in your neighborhood if they want to come. And whether you've got a Democrat, whether you've got an Obama, George Bush, makes no difference. You've got these same killers running, just marauding around the world with a license to kill, on top of the imperial wars, and threatening more right now against Syria and Iran. I mean they literally threatened to turn the whole world ablaze. Iran is no pushover. Syria has got a strong military. They literally threatened to embroil the entire region, possibly involving Russia and China defending its important regional interests. They threatened World War III. Don't the U.S. people have any notion in the world that any of this stuff is going on? Do they really believe that the absolute horrific reports that they're getting, the awful reports that they get on U.S. television mainly, where most people get what they call news, doesn't matter, Fox or all of them, CBS, NBC, they're all the same. They all maliciously go after whatever country's U.S. Targets. Right now it's Syria and Iran. Last year it was Libya. Do people have no idea that these countries are ravaged? Their people are mass slaughtered, arrested, tortured. I mean, this goes on endlessly. And yet, at the same time, as you say, fear is generated to make people believe these countries really are our enemies, that they want to harm us. What a bunch of rubbish. American people, I remember quoting, and I forget his name, this was a while back in an article, but I quoted a former president of Boston University in the early days of television around 1950, Peter, commenting on how bad it was then and saying, if his comment was something like, if this thing catches on, in 1950 you had to say that, if this thing catches on, we'll end up with a nation of morons. Quota morons was the word he used. Well, he was absolutely right. We have not only morons, we have a nation of indifferent morons. They're more concerned about whether their favorite sports team wins or whether they'll manage to get to see their favorite film or whatever their favorite pastime is than whether their country threatens to blow up the world. What kind of a country is this?
Well, it's a country where people, if they're primarily getting their news and information and entertainment from television, the mainstream corporate media, the capitalist media, that they're literally in a monoculture of the mind, that there's a frame of understanding that's limited, lacks diversity, but it has an emotional content. It has a content of fear. It has a content of titillation, a content of excitement. So whether it's the Super Bowl or the latest murder or the threats from another country or terrorist actions, it's a gossipy, titillating entertainment medium that creates a state of excited delirium of knowinglessness. In other words, people are excited, and they're gossipy, and they're all entertained, and they're just like, oh, my God, but they don't know, have any idea of what's really going on and what the powerful are doing and who benefits.
Peter, I once in a while I'll glance at a madly cheering sports crowd, a stadium absolutely jam-packed with people screaming their heads off about a silly game, whether it's football or basketball or baseball, whatever it is, and they have no idea that around them, out of sight and mind to them, the world is literally in danger of going up in flames, and they're mindlessly concentrating on this meaningless sports contest. That, I think, was the main reason I soured on sports years ago. There's nothing wrong with sports, but when it diverts public attention from what matters most, then it's an insidious tonic that literally diverts people's attention from where it really should be focused. There's nothing wrong with enjoying a ball game. That's fine, but not at the expense of protecting our freedoms. They're fundamental, and if we don't protect them, who will? And we literally live under governments. Bipartisan makes no difference, either party. They're destroying our rights. It's happening in real time, and if we don't do something to stop it, they'll all be gone, just the way they went in Nazi Germany. We're on the same path. It's a little smoother. Don't have a raging guy with a mustache making speeches. Imagine what he could have done with television. There was no television in those days, just radio and big open air or stadia where he would make speeches, and he aroused the entire German population to follow this monster. Well, basically, it's the same thing today. You know, Hitler used the scare tactics, and Goering explained it. That, I mean, you can never get people who want to go to war and leave their families and farms and the rest of it unless you scare the bejesus out of them, and then they'll do it to protect their families. So Americans are scared, and then they divert their attention to nonsense, and America gets away with murder.
Yeah. Yeah, Stephen, I think you're right, and... You know, I enjoy a nice ball game once in a while, but of being aware of and knowing that what the cost is, and many millions of people in this country are, there's a great concern with corporate media, top-down lies, managed news, propaganda. People don't always use those terminologies, but they know they're not getting the whole story. And like my father, who's he's 87 years old, he's a World War II vet, Purple Heart at Okinawa. He asked me to get him a T-shirt from the Veterans for Peace. And he goes, you know, it's not right we're invading other countries. That's not what America was. Of course, we were. I mean, Spanish-American War, I mean, there's some history there to be learned. But the values of what he believed World War II was about, even though there was lots of it was still the same sort of thing, the myth of the good war. But he certainly believed that. And he certainly believed in that we were there for freedom and to support the country and protect our families, and that's what he was about. And he says that, well, we don't do that anymore. There's no country in the world that can threaten us militarily, could invade us. There's certainly countries that could send bombs our way, and we would, of course, any country that did that, we would melt their entire population, and that's just insane. It's insane to think of those capabilities, and perhaps the dangerous inevitability that if you build weapon systems, ultimately they'll be used.
And Peter, the power of propaganda can get the majority of people in the country to believe that other countries or other groups actually threaten America, when the last enemy America had was before Japan surrendered in August 1945. America has not had a single enemy since then. A lot of people hate America. These are the ones that America invented by its policies. But America has no enemies. As you say, no country would dare attack America unless they had a self-immolation desire, in which case they better get rid of their leaders and get new ones, because the country no longer will exist.
Right. Exactly.
Oh, we're just about out of time, Peter. Final thoughts.
Well, Stephen, it's always fun to be on the air with you and talking to people on the Progressive Radio Network, and we really enjoyed that our show is played there on Friday afternoons as well.
OPRN is wonderful, and I know you and Mickey are on, and it's wonderful getting out real information to people. It's so important, and the work that you and Mickey, you did for so many years, and that Carl Jensen did before you at Project Censored, and now the Media Freedom Foundation. I can't imagine initiatives any more important than those. It's so wonderful, so important, Peter. Everyone needs to know about it, and anyone can Google Project Censored, simple Project Censored, or Media Freedom Foundation, and find all the information about it, including marvelous material you post on your websites all the time, and of course the annual Project Censored yearbook. Everybody should get it and read it. And this is what we need to do to protect ourselves. Then spread the word to others. And again, if we don't look after our own interests, nobody else is going to do it for us.
That's pretty much correct.
Peter, I look forward to getting you back again. It's marvelous. When you come on, when Mickey comes on, the other wonderful guests that I have on, and what you, and the type people that you bring on your programs, these are the people that everybody needs to listen to. And I can be a guest or I can be a host. I love having marvelous people like you, Peter, and Mickey, to explain things to people. Fundamental things that can be explained so simply, and you do it so well, and Mickey does it so well. It is so important, and people need to understand it. At the same time, I think I'm preaching to the choir, because people who listen to programs like this, they know what's going on. We need to spread the word to others who don't know the way my regular listeners know it, the way your regular listeners know it, Peter. So we all have an obligation to inform others, get them to tune into the alternative media, to find out all the updated information on what's really happening, the dangers we face, and this is our great defense. We just have to do it because we really are living through perilous times.
Well, Stephen, you're right, and I'm really glad that I was on with you today. It's always engaging.
Peter, I look forward to having you back again, and Mickey, too. Again, I'm very dedicated. In my senior years, this has become my calling. I simply can't imagine doing anything else. And like you, it's all volunteer. I don't want anybody to pay me 10 cents. I simply want to do something to help other people, especially the young people. They don't have the future that I had to look forward to. I want to do something to help them have a better future. I can't imagine a better way to spend my retirement.
Right.
Peter, many thanks. And
well,
I'll just remind
you.
Remind my listeners, do join us Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.